This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Deliver Us From Evil, written and read by yours truly, Sean Hannity. He was found cowering in a hole in the ground near a farmhouse in a desolate country town. Bewildered and disoriented, he only had the clothes on his back, a pistol, two AK-47s, and $750,000 in uncirculated American bills. This man who had terrorized and plundered his own people while living in immeasurable luxury spent his final hours before capture in a hiding place so base that it could only be described in terms befitting an animal. He was cornered like a rat, caught in a lizard's den, in a spider hole. Within hours, the sight of his face was being broadcast around the world. Haggard and disheveled, hidden behind a graying beard, this apostle of evil closed his eyes while a doctor probed under his tongue for hidden cyanide capsules. In Baghdad, the Iraqi people celebrated the event with jubilation. Radio stations played celebratory music as young men drove through the streets shouting their excitement. With the capture of this brutal despot, the world was granted a rare opportunity to look evil in the face. What we saw was a fugitive from righteous justice, a killer, broken without remorse, a man who had dispatched his own sons to die for his perverted cause, yet surrendered himself without a struggle. This pivotal moment, this reckoning, occurred because of the stern determination of an American president with a clear moral vision and courage to commit this country and its braved armed services to the cause of defeating international terrorism. A future once undreamed of by Iraqis is now within reach. Saddam, a man who only months ago was beyond the reaches of his own law, will be held accountable for his actions by the very people he mercilessly oppressed. His atrocities will be aired before the world and judged by a legitimate system of justice. In the end, God willing, Saddam Hussein will die for his crimes. And when our soldiers finally suppress the last loyalist insurgency, the Iraqi people, for the first time in a generation, will reclaim a measure of peace. In America, this event took place in the early days of a presidential election. At the time, it seemed to stop the president's already fragmented opposition in its tracks. For months, most of his Democratic opponents had been pretending to support the war while undermining the president at every turn. Now they paused at the edge of the precipice to regroup and reconsider how to capture even a small part of the spotlight, how to find a dark cloud in the silver lining. None of them succeeded. John Kerry called Saddam's capture, quote, an important step towards stabilizing Iraq for the Iraqis, but soon reverted to form, calling upon the administration to, quote, share the burden, bring in other countries, and make it clear to the world that Iraq belongs to the Iraqi people, unquote. Wesley Clark said he hoped it would lead to, quote, a diminishing in the violence against American soldiers in Iraq. Carol Moseley Braun called the capture, quote, good news, but claimed that it, quote, does not change the fact that our troops remain in harm's way and we are no closer to bringing them home, unquote. Governor Howard Dean made the most improbable claim of all, quote, the capture of Saddam, he ventured, has not made America safer. His contention was met with mingled scorn and silence. Over all their heads hung the inevitable thought, if America had followed your path, Saddam Hussein would still be in power today. President Bush, in contrast, kept his focus on the task at hand, prosecuting the war on terror to its conclusion. Quote, now the former dictator of Iraq will face the justice that he denied to millions, President Bush told America. For the vast majority of Iraqi citizens, the torture chambers and the secret police are gone forever. Quote, we've come to this moment through patience and resolve and focused action. Our security is preserved by our perseverance. And he capped his remarks with this renewed pledge. The USA will not relent until the war is won. Justice, patience, resolve, and focused action, the principles that drove this evil actor from the world stage. As America casts its eye to the future, let us not forget them. We'll need them again. 3 years ago, evil surfaced in the Western world in a way it had not in 6 decades since the day of infamy at Pearl Harbor. Americans were forced to confront pure human wickedness in a way we had not in generations. And in that moment, we rose as one nation to the challenge, led fortunately by a leader who had the clarity of vision to recognize that evil for what it was and to rally America and the world against it. Even many of the most committed liberals seemed to have their compasses reoriented in the face of that unmistakable act of war and crime against humanity. But nearly 3 years have passed, and in the intervening time, our wounds have healed, our senses and memories dulled, the nation rallied behind its leader long enough to expel the state sponsors of evil in Afghanistan, yet by the time the confrontation with Iraq presented itself, our courage and moral certainty seemed to fade in the face of partisan bickering and posturing. We toppled a murderous dictator in Iraq, and yet now the political left and the Democratic Party are trying to use the demanding aftermath of the war to exploit our national cause for their own political advantage. How could we allow ourselves to forget so soon? I decided to make this recording because I believe it is our responsibility to recognize and confront evil in the world, and because I'm convinced that if we fail in that mission, it will lead us to a disaster. Evil exists. It is real, and it means to harm us. I believe this strongly, and not just because of my Catholic faith, although that's the root of it. When you work in the news business, you deal with the ugly side of life. Every day across your desk comes story after story about man's inhumanity to man, from mass murderers to child molesters, to mothers who drown their children, to fathers who murder their pregnant wives. These stories push the limits of our ability to imagine man's inhumanity toward man, and yet they are horrifically true. Still, isolated events like these pale beside the pure evil of September 11th. How could anyone witness the horrors of that day or the mass graves discovered in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein and dismiss the idea of evil? And yet many people do, most of them political liberals. It's difficult for liberals to see moral questions clearly because most of them are moral relativists. They reject absolute standards of right and wrong. In their worldview, man is perfectible. Human nature is on a linear path towards enlightenment. The concept of sin is primitively biblical. In their view, society's unfairness compels people to break the law. To them, people like Saddam and Osama bin Laden are not morally depraved murderers, but men driven to their bad acts by the injustices of Western society. The emphasis is always on giving bad actors, domestic and foreign, the benefit of the doubt, never on personal accountability. The trouble with tolerating evil, of course, is that while we're averting our eyes, the evil itself only grows and festers around the world. This has been true throughout history. Neville Chamberlain assured a wary England that an appeasement pact with Adolf Hitler would lead to, quote-unquote, peace in our time. Cold War liberal elitists ignored or downplayed the atrocities of communism, from the gulag of Uncle Joe Stalin to the killing fields of Cambodia. Bill Clinton stood idly by while Islamic terrorists attacked American targets throughout the 1990s in a long prelude that should have alerted us to the burgeoning war on America. The primary evil we face today is terrorism, but we will never triumph over terrorists until we realize that groups like Al-Qaeda are not working alone. Without the deep pockets of terrorist-friendly dictatorships like Saddam Hussein's Iraq to support them, the loose networks of Islamic terrorism would pose only a fraction of the danger to civilization that they currently do. And those dictatorships, we must realize, are the same brutal regimes that have oppressed their own people for generations. As President Bush has declared, we can no longer wait around for the terrorists to attack us. We must take the war to them, rooting them out of their swamps and destroying their despotic regimes that furnish their lifeblood. One challenge of a long and drawn-out war is that public commitment to that effort can flag, especially in an unpredictable situation like the war on terror, where a few weeks of dramatic battle can be followed by months of difficult activity behind the scenes. And if the public should lose its resolve to win, if its attention should wander from the evil that confronts us and the necessity of defeating it, victory will only stray further from our reach. Under such circumstances, some of the most dangerous attacks our nation faces can come from those on the home front. And when it comes to confronting evil, the sad fact is that there are essentially two types of people: those who are willing to fight it and those who try to excuse it, or worse, deny it even exists. Throughout history, the appeasers have refused to recognize evil, let alone confront it. They make excuses for it, ignore and coddle it. And by refusing to fight, they nourish and encourage it. Every great champion of freedom in the modern era has had to overcome a prominent voice of appeasement. For Winston Churchill, there was Chamberlain. For Ronald Reagan, there was Jimmy Carter. Today, George W. Bush faces the modern Democratic Party. Indeed, the greatest threat to our resolve today in the war on terror is political liberalism and selfish opportunism of the Democrats. Terrorism, despotism, and liberalism, these are the forces America must be concerned about in the war on terror today. Ever since September 11th, the voices of the left have been treating the terrorists as though they were merely another player in the same old political game. They have tried to play both ends against the middle, aligning themselves with the war effort when it suited their political needs, but shifting their allegiances as soon as an election loomed on the horizon. But the terrorists are no mere political sideshow. Though it manifests itself differently, the threat they represent is every bit as grave as that we experienced during World War II or the Cold War. There is no appeasing this enemy. They will stop at nothing in their quest to destroy the United States of America, and they will waste every human life they can in the process. We face the possibility of our civilization being destroyed as surely as we did during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Indeed, with recent advances in technology and the ongoing instability in the Middle East and around the world, that danger may be worse than ever. We rose to the challenge then. We cannot afford to fall short now. Despite the irrefutable evil of terrorism, there are those who still have doubts about whether absolute evil truly exists. They look at the world through the warped perspective of moral relativism and persist in believing that every bad act can be blamed on social or psychological circumstances, on economic or cultural differences. Now, I believe that's just what has happened to the leaders of the modern Democratic Party. Unlike President Bush, who has personified moral clarity and vision in the war on terror, America's liberal elite sneers at the quote-unquote simplistic notion that good and evil are legitimate concepts in our society. They mock the president for seeing the world in such starkly black and white terms and even impugn his Christian faith for inspiring the thought. They've even convinced themselves that President Bush's moral compass is a dangerous instrument, as threatening, some have hinted, as Islamic fundamentalism itself. But this kind of moral relativism is disturbing to me as an American. It discounts the very idea of accountability, devalues our right to fight for our principles, and without an unwavering grasp of what is right and what is wrong, how can we ever expect to stand in judgment of our terrorist enemies? By blurring the lines between good and evil, liberals have rendered our society more vulnerable to evil's influence. With secular liberals largely in charge of our cultural institutions, not to mention their influence on the courts and even our churches, America is increasingly ill-equipped to recognize, much less respond to, the evil that threatens the nation. Today's moral relativism is clearly out of step with the traditions of our nation, as the framers' own words reveal. The founders of our country recognized the presence of evil in the world and in human nature and the necessity to take it into account when creating a government. Quote, if men were angels, James Madison wrote, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself, unquote. John Adams warned, quote, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. That's the reason that conservatives are dedicated to oppose the erosion of our traditional moral values. Moral relativism, we recognize moral values as the foundation of our constitutional liberties. It's true that conservatives generally favor less control by the federal government, but conservatives don't object to every energetic exercise of governmental power. We heartily endorse the government taking a proactive role in those areas that the framers intended, such as foreign policy and national security. By and large, unless they happen to be in power at the time, liberals tend to take a dim view of governmental action in these areas. And all too often, their reluctance to use force leads them to excuse the evil behavior of foreign regimes, to offer appeasement to tyrants, and blame U.S. policy for planting the seeds of evil. Conservatives see things much differently. We believe that America is a superior society, not because Americans are superior human beings, but because our culture was founded on a recognition of our God-given natural rights, the unalienable rights referred to in the Declaration of Independence. From that awareness flows a basic shared respect for humanity, individual liberty, limited government, and the rule of law. More than 225 years after that declaration, America has become, without rival, the world's most beneficent nation. As Ronald Reagan was fond of reminding his Soviet counterparts, we have the power to conquer any nation, but we don't. We have the power to enslave any people, but we don't. We have the power to loot any nation of its natural resources, but we don't. Instead, America sends her young men and women to war to defend the weak. She sends her resources to help feed the poor, and she offers a hand to any nation that seeks friendship and peace. Liberals have shown a constant reluctance to confront the enemies of freedom around the world. They preach the absolute value of peace, accuse every Republican leader of quote-unquote warmongering, and act to cut defense spending whenever possible. Yet many of America's greatest moments have come when its people have taken up arms to defend liberty. Was it warmongering when the greatest generation defeated the Axis powers of Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, Tojo's Japan, and liberated untold millions in World War II? When President Reagan took his courageous stand against communism and renewed the commitment to our military strength, which led to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of Soviet oppression? When today's brave soldiers rescued 26 million people in Afghanistan and 24 million in Iraq from brutal regimes? George W. Bush makes liberals very nervous, not just because he won the presidency back for the Republicans after 8 years of Bill Clinton, but because he truly understands and articulates the bigger picture. Like most of America's great leaders, he has grasped the nature of evil. He has risen to the occasion, exercising decisive leadership, all the while firmly and openly relying on God, a fact that disturbs liberals even more. In the president's public statements during those frightening days after 9/11, when the nation looked for direction and confidence, he spoke of first principles, our founding principles, which were and remain the target of our enemies. As the president knew, it is from those very principles that we draw our strength, not from liberal notions of diversity and tolerance, but from our Judeo-Christian roots. Those themes are normally anathema to liberals, but during the brief post-9/11 honeymoon, the secular liberals held their tongues. And I have no doubt that some of them were sincere in their momentary ceasefire, caught up in the emotion of the moment. But it didn't take long for the left to get back on message. Soon they were publicly mocking President Bush for invoking the concepts of good and evil and the spiritual implications of this struggle. Editorial writers, they gasped at the horror of America's commander-in-chief harboring such a, quote, simplistic and dangerous worldview. As liberals eventually shook the mantle of patriotism from their shoulders, their attacks became more pointed and mean-spirited. Assaults on the president's faith and worldview returned with a vengeance. Not only did they question his propriety and judgment in openly acknowledging God, they complained that such statements were offensive to Muslims. Well, that would be laughable if it weren't so infuriating. A group of Islamic extremists attack us because we're largely a Judeo-Christian nation that supports Israel, and we're supposed to keep silent about our religious faith? Well, I've heard of political correctness, but this is taking it to absurd extremes, and it only shows how far liberals have strayed from the American mainstream. The day a president cannot invoke God as his guiding light and the source from which he and our nation derive strength and direction is the day America ceases to be great. Today, with the Taliban deposed in Afghanistan and Saddam toppled in Iraq, liberal voices are grasping at every straw they can, trying to prove their relevance in the post-9/11 world. After the Bush administration and its allies scored a decisive victory in Iraq, overthrowing a brutal dictator who had gassed his own people and thumbed its nose at world opinion for years, all the Democrats can do is fume about the quote-unquote missing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Certain they've located the president's Achilles heel. They claim boldly that he, quote unquote, lied about the existence of nuclear weapons in Iraq. The Democrats on the Hill and those who are running for president in 2004 can't see past their myopic hatred of George Bush. They can't get beyond their partisan pettiness to understand the sobering reality of what we've discovered in Iraq. If there's any reason to be disturbed, it's not because the weapons programs were never there. Voices from all sides, from Bill Clinton to the former Iraqi scientists who have described such programs in detail, have confirmed that Saddam's regime was intent on building an arsenal of WMDs. The real question is whether Saddam was able to hide the evidence before the Allied invasion or if he managed to smuggle it out to like-minded nations. The Iraqi regime was evil beyond imagination, as the evidence has now proven beyond any doubt. We know that he ordered the mass extermination of Shiite Muslims, Kurds, and other political enemies on an unthinkable scale. We have found botulinum toxins, mobile weapons labs, and more than 100 general munition storage facilities in his country. We know that he supported terrorism against Israel, among other nations, and that he was capable of using weapons of mass destruction against America, and that he had used weapons of mass destruction against the Iranians and Kurds. And we have seen tapes of his medieval torture chambers, of rooms where unknown hundreds of citizens were raped, of mass graves filled with murdered Iraqi citizens. Yet liberals still refuse to acknowledge that our invasion was a beneficial thing. They're more tolerant of Saddam Hussein than they are of George W. Bush. Back in 1998, when their own president, Bill Clinton, turned his attention briefly to Saddam, the Democrats hardly wasted a breath criticizing him. In fact, during the Clinton years, the Democrats seemed to have no problem with the idea of military intervention overseas. They supported Clinton's endless deployments, regardless of cost and regardless of whether American interests were truly at stake. Yet now that we are really at war, now that we've been unmistakably attacked, they demand the strictest burden of proof before consenting to military action. And even when they do consent, they later try to wiggle out of it, as Senator John Kerry has done. Now that the public has learned this much about the evils of Saddam Hussein's regime, though it's chilling to realize that Bill Clinton knew about it all during his 8 years in office and yet took no effective action to stop it. Hamstrung by the liberal unwillingness to defy evil in the strongest terms, Clinton tolerated the human rights violations and growing military threat Iraq posed to the world. He appeased the blustering dictator. On the few occasions when Clinton did respond to Saddam's chicanery, he did so in feckless half measures, lobbed over a handful of cruise missiles that did little damage and provided no deterrent. And in doing so, Bill Clinton made Saddam bolder and Iraq stronger. There, in a nutshell, is the difference between a powerful leader and an ineffectual failure. Where Bush has shown courage and strength in the face of challenge, Clinton was simply short-sighted and reckless, and America paid dearly for his neglect. I thank God at the time of 9/11 that our new president had the courage to see the events for the declaration of war that they were. Quote, from this day forward, the president told the American people in a joint session of Congress on September the 20th, quote, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime. President Bush was able to build a serious international coalition to topple the tyrannical Taliban regime in Afghanistan. But by the time the conflict with Iraq came to a head early in 2003, the liberal nations of Europe and much of the Arab world had withdrawn its support. It was alarming and frustrating to see just how many world leaders had fallen back in love with appeasement. Their refusal to support our reasonable response had nothing to do with any supposed failure of diplomacy on the Bush administration's part. Rather, it reflected these nations' political antipathy toward America and their general cowardice when it comes to confronting evil actors on the world stage. It was as if Bill Clinton's appeasement virus had suddenly infected the rest of the world. To liberals, the pacifist approach may appear more civilized, but human nature and the lessons of history tell us that such naive efforts to avoid bloodshed generally lead to even greater bloodshed. Pacifism, in short, rarely leads to peace and never to freedom or security. Ronald Reagan, the 20th century's greatest president, intimately understood the importance of confronting evil. Quote, trust but verify, he famously warned, describing the perils of dealing with the Soviet Union. But the full text of Reagan's advice may be even more important. Trust but verify, he said, and don't be afraid to see what you see. As a member of the World War II generation, Reagan well remembered the dangers of trying to negotiate with brutal and unscrupulous regimes. Those who refuse to see evil for what it is are doomed to relive history's most tragic lessons. Despite their seeming support in the first few weeks after 9/11, American liberals began to show their true colors as soon as George Bush's tough talk graduated into military action. The liberal media revealed its essential lack of confidence in our military strength and resolve, clucking that if the formidable Soviet army couldn't defeat Afghanistan, we might not be able to do it either. A few weeks after 9/11, when our forces went into action, the New York Times editorial issued a naysaying statement complete with the liberals' customary allusions to Vietnam. Quote, the recent era of nearly casualty-free American military operations abroad, including the airstrikes against Afghanistan, seemed to have ended yesterday as combat operations commenced on the ground. This is just one of the grim realities that come with this new and more dangerous phase of the war against terrorism. The nation should brace itself, emotionally and politically, for the kind of close combat it has not seen over an extended period since the Vietnam War. The implication of these statements was clear. America, the Times believed, was not strong enough to conquer these foes, so we might as well compromise before we suffer too much. It was only the latest evidence of how little faith the Times, traditionally considered the newspaper of record, truly has in the resolve of the American military. A month later, as the Battle of Afghanistan drew to a close, even the liberal media was forced to concede our victory. Tom Ram of the Associated Press, a journalist who has covered five presidencies, said it all with his opening paragraph on November the 25th. Quote, Afghan Taliban rulers have been routed, the Al-Qaeda terror network breached, and Osama bin Laden put on the run, a fugitive with a $25 million bounty on his head, and suddenly some important goals in President Bush's war on terrorism seem within grasp, unquote. But the appeasement lobby has a short memory for the lessons of war. Toward the end of 2002, the media went through the very same cycle during the buildup of the invasion of Iraq. Even before European nations like France and Germany withdrew their support, the press went digging for dissent anywhere they could find it. Clearly, the lessons of appeasement must be learned over and over again. America in 2004 is confronted with a special challenge. In November, we will go to the polls to vote for president. But this year, and quite possibly for many years to come, this race is about more than just the niceties of tax policies and the size of government. It's about choosing a leader who possesses the moral vision to recognize evil and the will to confront it. And regardless of which candidate stands for the Democratic Party in November, America must realize that the candidate who opposes George Bush will be the candidate of appeasement. He will be standing for the party of Jimmy Carter, of Bill Clinton, for the party of moral relativism, of toleration and hesitation in the face of threats at home and abroad. Our nation cannot afford another Carter, another Clinton. As we confront this critical moment in our history, let us first turn to the lessons of history, starting with the disgraceful record of appeasement during the Second World War. As an American who feels strongly about the reality of evil in the world, a reality recognized by our greatest modern presidents, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, I often wonder why we as a nation have grown so resistant to the very idea of absolute evil. Perhaps it's because those my age and younger have always known freedom. For our entire lives, we've enjoyed a level of peace and liberty unimaginable to earlier generations of Americans, not to mention the rest of the world. Can it be that since so few of us have had to sacrifice anything to preserve our freedom, that we tend to undervalue this gift our predecessors bestowed upon us? Or perhaps we have such a hard time recognizing evil abroad because of our own popular culture's disdain for American values here at home? There's long been a prevailing attitude in the culture that the United States doesn't deserve its prosperity, that we're unfairly exploiting a disproportionate share of the world's resources. The left-wing elites in this country have pushed their obsessive anti-Americanism so far that they've lost all perspective of the real evils being perpetrated around the world. There was a time within our parents' lifetime when Americans banded together to fight a power universally recognized as evil, when petty political opposition evaporated in the face of a common enemy. We entered World War II not just to protect Hitler from attacking America, but to save the peoples of Europe. It was in large measure a selfless act, no hesitation, no second guessing, no partisan bickering or recrimination, and the liberated Europeans welcomed us with open arms. To me, the most important lesson of World War II is that evil is a reality and that confronting it is the only course of action. Nazism was the purest form of evil modern man has known. It was rooted in virulent anti-Semitism, hatred of biblical Judeo-Christianity, and the firm belief that the state, not any higher power, is the ultimate source of truth. Even today, it remains astonishing that the depths of depravity witnessed in the Nazi Holocaust occurred within a historically Christian nation. But Winston Churchill recognized that the evils of the Third Reich were rooted in barbarous paganism and rejection of Christian ethics. But evil did not disappear from the world when the Allies defeated Nazism in 1945. Today, in the early 21st century, we are once again facing an absolute evil. Its scope has not reached that of Nazi Germany, thank God, but its nature is the same. Somehow, though, liberals in our culture refuse to recognize dictators like Saddam Hussein as evil. Instead, they dismiss them as madmen. Instead of judging a terrorist like Osama bin Laden in absolute terms, they grope for excuses and reasons to lay the blame on America. It must have been something we did, they say. The crime lies with us, with our successful system and thriving culture and booming economy. It's important that we remember our role in the fight against Nazi Germany, even as we confront a new species of evil today. When President Bush visited Auschwitz in 2003, he inscribed a simple message in the guestbook, quote, "Never forget." With his leadership in the war on terror, he reminds us that we must do more than remember the horrors of the Holocaust. We must take a page from our own history and rise to confront evil once again. In the story of Nazi Germany, we see what happens when man forsakes faith, morality, and conscience in favor of unquestioned loyalty to the state. In contemporary America, the instances of evil we witness tend to be isolated. The tragedy of one little girl kidnapped from her home, never to be found again. A series of fatal shootings around Washington, D.C., leaving 10 dead and 6 more wounded. And yet millions of people were killed in such fashion during the Holocaust, many of them children grabbed by Nazi SS from Jewish orphanages and tossed into the backs of trucks like stray dogs. With the passage of time, the horror of state-sponsored evil tends to fade, to be reduced to statistics. Yet the numbers hide millions of individual stories, each of them as heartrending as the worst of today's headlines. One fact that's increasingly lost to history is the way Hitler and his evil agenda slithered into power in what was then a democratic Germany. Disguising himself as a statesman, this demon was first appointed by the democratically elected leader of Germany, his nature largely unnoticed by an unsuspecting electorate and an apathetic world community. He then proceeded to charm and intimidate world leaders as if he were merely a canny diplomat and not a murderous tyrant. At first, his own people and most of the world were fooled by his wiles. Though many dismiss him today as a deranged megalomaniac, Hitler possessed the personal skills, charisma, and mental capacity to fulfill his evil intentions by devising, executing, and almost winning a war against the greatest powers of the world. Though in retrospect, Adolf Hitler seems unmistakably evil, in his time he managed to cast his spell over some influential political figures. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor were photographed with him and may have hoped to return to power in a Nazified Great Britain. Even America's ambassador to the Court of St. James, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., was at least initially sympathetic. As Edward Renahan Jr. has written, Kennedy and his friend Viscountess Nancy Astor saw Hitler as, quote, a welcome solution to the world problems of communism and Judaism in Europe. As Renahan points out, Kennedy told his Nazi counterpart at the Court of St. James that Franklin Roosevelt was the, quote, victim of Jewish influence, and the German reported back that Kennedy was Germany's best friend in London. And of course, Neville Chamberlain, England's prime minister, was also charmed and convinced of Hitler's sincerity. Now, I know it's painful to read books and see films that depict the horrors of the Holocaust, but the only way to come to terms with such absolute evil is to confront it directly, not avoid it or dilute it with psychosociological theories that explain it away. Rather than treating the Holocaust as dry history, I believe we must pull something deeper from it, something real that can make us understand evil more intimately. It's not just the mass killing we need to explore, it's also the Nazi philosophy that gave rise to it and the cold-hearted bureaucracy that carried it out. The Nazi bureaucrats, for example, were responsible for seizing the wealth of the victims, from their real estate and bank accounts right down to their jewelry and luggage. Since the concentration camp system had no formal budget to pay expenses, which would have left too much of a paper trail, monies, quote-unquote, earned from the deportation and mass killing were placed in a Nazi SS bank account to, quote, defray costs. Even railroad cargo costs for the human, quote-unquote, shipments had to be paid for by the SS to draw as little attention as possible to their horrific system. Nothing, quote-unquote, useful was wasted, from the hair on their heads to the gold in their teeth. It all went into Nazi coffers, counted and allotted day after day by untold numbers of Nazi loyalists who went home every day to their families. More than 70% of European Jews were slaughtered in these camps during the war, and millions of other human beings with them, men and women and children and babies. But it didn't happen with a snap of the fingers. You can't kill millions of people in the midst of a functioning society without a system, a plan devised by evil bureaucrats and executed by quote-unquote efficient men who had analyzed all the difficulties of managing the so-called task and who worked constantly to refine the quote-unquote process. As documents from the Nazi era reveal, the efficiency of this genocide was also abetted by virulent anti-Semitic propaganda, which demonized victims and glorified their Nazi murderers. The Jews were depicted as members of a quote-unquote international conspiracy against National Socialist Germany, who operated as parasites on society, extracting society's resources for their covetous benefit. They were considered lesser beings whose extermination would benefit society as a whole. Even while waging war in 1941, propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels kept up his public excoriation of the Jewish people. In an article for the Nazi weekly Das Reich, he claimed that the Jews had, quote, provoked the war because they intended to, quote, destroy the German state and nation. Every Jew, wrote Goebbels, is the sworn enemy of the German people. Every German soldier's death in this war is the, quote, Jews' responsibility. And the Jews, he concluded, quote, must pay for it. He charged Germany's enemy nations with protecting the Jews, proving, quote, their destructive role among our people. He told his German readers that the Jews had no claim to equal rights and that they should be silenced wherever they want to open their mouths. Even if a Jew should perform an act of kindness toward them, he warned his readers not to be fooled and to punish him in return with contempt. Some might categorize such thought as the ravings of a psychopath. In my opinion, though, to dismiss Goebbels' attitude as the byproduct of mental disability is to miss the point. Whatever his psychological makeup, it's clear that this madman was pursuing a conscious and deliberate campaign to spread anti-Semitic hatred throughout the German people. His motives, his words and actions, and their consequences were all unthinkably cruel and undeniably evil. In the end, it was only through the courageous leadership of Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt that the Third Reich was finally confronted with the consequences of its actions. In taking on the German military, a war machine every bit as fierce as the Nazi death machine that created and carried out the Holocaust, the Allies were compelled by three basic principles. One, that totalitarian government is the enemy of freedom. That the systematic oppression and cruelty it fosters is not merely senseless, but absolutely evil. And that appeasement can never defeat that evil, it can only prolong it. As the war on terror progresses, these three lessons are equally important today. I'll say it again, the most profound political lesson of the Holocaust is that totalitarian states are a breeding ground for evil. The voracious evil of a Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, or more recently Saddam Hussein's Iraq, can only survive under a totalitarian regime and a closed society where dissent is outlawed and the tenets of traditional morality are replaced by the dictates of the state. The idea of subordinating the individual to the state wasn't born in 1930s Germany. It was firmly rooted in the irreligious philosophies that spread through Europe in the 19th century, giving rise to Marxist communism, socialism, and eventually their fascist cousin, National Socialism or Nazism. These essentially atheistic belief systems replaced God with the state, often imbuing its leader with quasi-religious powers, as the Bolsheviks did with Lenin and the Nazis did with their Führer. The Nazi movement is well recognized for its anti-Semitism, but it was also virulently opposed to the tenets of Christianity. It was enthralled to philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche's vision of a Superman, which is built on the belief that Aryans were superhumans and Jews non-humans. Nietzsche had famously declared that God is dead, and the leaders of the Third Reich saw that without God, the state and its leaders were free to shape morality for themselves. In the Nazis' German Christianity, Hitler stood in place of God. He decided who lived, who died. For a government to perpetuate such evil on a whole people, innocent of any wrongdoing, it has to have absolute power. It must see itself as superior to any limiting concept of God or truth or justice. The notion of higher moral order to be determined by the state's convenience, writes historian Paul Johnson, was to find expression in the 20th century in what Lenin called the revolutionary conscience and Hitler the higher law of the party. The two systems with the same root, totally alien to the founding principle of the United States of America, which claimed its right to freedom by pointing to the Creator. Today, most liberals and many academic historians place Nazism and communism as two extreme ends of the ideological spectrum, far right and far left. But in truth, these two totalitarian models are actually very similar. Both were avowedly socialistic, and both established the state as God, just as liberalism increasingly does today. Ronald Reagan recognized the fallacy of calling Nazism a, quote, far-right philosophy, and he called his liberal opponents on the issue. In his eyes, it was not a matter of left or right, but of up or down, up toward individual freedom or down toward the tyranny of statism. Just as totalitarian states have historically been fertile ground for evil, in today's world they're also ripe for collusion with terrorists. Having no higher moral compass, the totalitarian regime forges its alliances on the basis of power and expedience. Thus, it should come as no surprise that terrorists get their nourishment from these regimes. It's the symbiotic relationship these totalitarian states have forged with their terrorist henchmen. They are the direct descendants of the tyrannical regimes of the last century, including Nazi Germany. They are united by a bond of evil that transcends the generations. In the wake of the 2003 Iraq War, Saddam's legacy of terror toward his own people was laid bare before the world. Soon after his overthrow, American troops discovered horrific torture chambers in places like Iraq's Military Intelligence Directorate, where a grim paper trail documented decades of atrocities. Pictures of dead Iraqis with their necks slashed, their eyes gouged, and their genitals blackened fill a bookshelf, Jack Kelly wrote in USA Today. Jail cells with dried blood on the floor and rusted shackles bolted to the walls lined the corridors, and the screams of what could be imprisoned men in an underground detention center echo through air shafts and sewer pipes. By November, human rights officials in Iraq reported the discovery of 250 mass graves dating to Saddam's regime, estimating that they might hold the bodies of hundreds of thousands of executed Iraqis. Even today, in the aftermath of the war in Iraq, the evidence is mounting that Saddam Hussein's regime was also in collusion with Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. In a detailed article based on top-secret U.S. intelligence documents, Stephen F. Hayes in the Weekly Standard has revealed that Saddam's lieutenants held regular meetings with bin Laden and his emissaries from 1990 through the period immediately before the American invasion in 2003. CIA reports from 1993 reveal that bin Laden wanted to expand his organization's capabilities through ties with Iraq, and that Saddam's vice president and other intelligence officials met with al-Qaeda leaders in Baghdad, Sudan, and Afghanistan in 1998 and 1999. Even today, the anti-war lobby still dismisses the evidence that Saddam was in league with the terrorists. Yet here is a man who had tortured and killed thousands of innocent Iraqis for the merest infractions, who gassed his own people, who ruled by fear and fiat. How can anyone believe he would hesitate to join forces with bin Laden? As President Bush has said, the nations who support terrorism are also our enemies. Those who deny that connection between the terrorists and their state sponsors do so at our peril. In the media, Adolf Hitler is commonly described as a madman. In conversation, I've often heard him referred to as crazy. Psychoanalyst Alice Miller, whose book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, is a favorite of Al Gore, is one of several academics who have linked Hitler's behavior to his abuse by his father. But I'm suspicious of any attempt to go hunting for root causes in Adolf Hitler's childhood. To me, looking for some psychological explanation for his campaign to decimate the Jewish population of Europe is a dangerous distraction. The behavior of a cold and vicious mass murderer like Adolf Hitler or Saddam Hussein is the result of conscious choice. If we fail to evaluate it on moral terms, looking for excuses from the past instead of lessons for the future, we risk losing our own moral compass. And this raises another question. If a childhood psychological disturbance is supposed to excuse the behavior of a Hitler or Saddam, then how did his disorder permeate the minds of millions of Germans? After all, hundreds of thousands of Germans directly cooperated with Hitler and Saddam and didn't manage his decades of oppression without the participation of thousands of loyalists. Certainly, fear must have played a part. It's true that the Nazis tortured and killed resistors, but the real explanation, to my mind, is simple. The evil intentions of a charismatic leader have often incited groups of followers to band together in evil and immoral behavior. The liberal elites prefer to avoid using the word evil. For them, the term is too judgmental. It smacks of religion, of fundamentalism. Reflecting on George Bush's reference to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as an axis of evil, University of Chicago professor Mark Lila wrote, quote, "How, one wonders, did the president and his speechwriters blunder into this mess?" Susan Sontag, one of the most strident voices of moral relativism since September 11th, has referred to President Bush's use of the word as jihad language. By dismissing evil as a social construct, relabeling it as the product of hard times or childhood abuse, as so often happens in our nation's court systems, we gradually become desensitized to death, losing our sense of the individual worth and dignity of human life. And in the end, we forfeit our ability to make moral judgments. Those who fail to recognize evil finally are doomed to fall into the trap of appeasement. And no story in the last century has thrown the danger of appeasement into greater relief than the sorry tale of Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, who tried to beg peace with Adolf Hitler and returned having lost everything at the bargaining table. The contrast between Chamberlain and his successor, Winston Churchill, is an object lesson for anyone who still believes a murderer like Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden can be tamed by half measures. Like all appeasers, Chamberlain should have seen it coming. The Nazi rise to power in the years before Munich was swift and merciless. In January 1933, Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany, head of the cabinet, and in February, a suspicious fire burned down the Reichstag, leading to mass arrests by the Gestapo. Enemies and perceived enemies of the Nazi Party were murdered in the streets. By April of that year, the Nazi-controlled Reichstag had passed a series of laws that gave Hitler absolute power over Germany, rendering its constitution meaningless. In a few short years, the Nazi Party had remade itself as a state within a state, banning newspapers that didn't support its dogma, dissolving non-Nazi labor unions, outlawing other political parties, summarily suspending civil rights for political opponents. And it had demanded that all members of the German military swear a personal loyalty oath to Adolf Hitler. By 1938, after nearly 5 years of oppression at home, Nazi Germany had annexed Austria and was spoiling to invade the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia. First under Stanley Baldwin, then under Neville Chamberlain, Great Britain had looked on in fear as Hitler's appetites grew. When the Sudetenland crisis erupted, Chamberlain went to Munich to meet with Hitler and returned to announce that he had agreed not to oppose Germany's annexation of the region in deference to, quote, the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. At 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence, Chamberlain told his anxious nation, quote, my good friends, for the second time in our history, a British Prime Minister has returned from Germany bringing peace with honor. I believe it is peace for our time. Go home and get a nice, quiet sleep. Well, it took the moral vision of Winston Churchill, one of Chamberlain's chief critics, to recognize the dangerous folly of the Prime Minister's position. Quote, we have sustained a defeat without war, Churchill said, and do not suppose that this is the end. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup. How did Churchill see what Chamberlain missed? Each man had access to the same information about Hitler and Nazi Germany. Each had many years of political experience. When Chamberlain returned from his meeting with Hitler, he felt certain that he had secured victory for his people. Yet Churchill knew at once, as history has confirmed, that the Munich Pact was one of the most grievous acts of self-delusion in history. Ultimately, Chamberlain and Churchill had entirely different views of human nature. Churchill knew evil when he saw it. He knew the Nazis were the opposite of everything Britain stood for and that they needed to be stopped. He was wise enough to know that the British people would greet the news from Munich with relief. At least at first, war had been averted. But he also knew that the other shoe had yet to drop, and that Britain and the world would pay a horrible price for their denial. Churchill was a moral force against that darkness, not only because he warned Britain of Nazi Germany's evil designs, though he was mocked by appeasers for doing so, but also because he called attention to the basic spiritual enmity between the two countries. He knew that nations needed not only martial vigor, but moral health to fight. What would happen if we in America were faced with the same challenges today? I'd say we already are. And while George W. Bush has honored Winston Churchill's example in confronting evil, the voices of appeasement have been even stronger than they were in London in the 1930s. I'm convinced that the growth of international terrorism could pose as dire a threat to our national security as Hitler posed to Britain in the 1930s. And if Churchill were among us today, I'm afraid his warnings would be met with squabbling and derision by the mainstream media and by leading Democrats and liberals who are eager to exploit the war for their own partisan advantage. When President Bush focused attention on Saddam Hussein's growing defiance of world opinion in 2002, he was met with nothing but opposition from the left. As Saddam thwarted international weapons inspectors, shredded the Gulf War Treaty, and ignored one UN resolution after another, anti-war activists at home and abroad pressed for more time, more negotiation, more accommodation. Even today, as American troops work to maintain peace and build a stable government in Iraq, the appeasers protest our presence there, hoping that their attacks will buy them a few votes in November. Like Neville Chamberlain, today's appeasers are fooling themselves about the realities of war. They insist that the avenue to, quote, peace in our time is through accommodating and pacifying the enemy. They refuse to understand the inherent moral corruption of totalitarian regimes like Saddam's or terrorist networks like Bin Laden's. They reject the very notion of evil, grasping instead at sociological explanations and psychological excuses. As I've often said on my radio show, liberals define peace as an absence of conflict or an absence of war. As a conservative, on the other hand, I believe that true peace can only be maintained when a nation has the ability and the courage to defend itself. There is no question in my mind that if the terrorists keep pursuing their murderous agenda, one day there will be an appeasement candidate in the Democratic Party. In fact, that day may already have come. But to elect such a candidate would be to put ourselves in the hands of another Neville Chamberlain. The appeasers may prefer to ignore history, but the horrors of the Holocaust demand that we never forget. We must never again be ambushed by a ruthless enemy as Britain was before World War II, as we were before September 11, 2001. We owe it to those who died and to our children to remain vigilant in the battle against evil. And in doing so, let us turn forward a few decades to take a lesson from America's great crusader for freedom, Ronald Reagan. If there's ever been a nation that embodied the principle that totalitarianism and evil go hand in hand, it's the Soviet Union. Yet even today, with the USSR fully dismantled, repudiated, gone from the face of the earth, and an entire generation of survivors bearing witness to its evils, much of the American public has failed to register the enormity of the evil its murderous leaders perpetrated. Why? Well, at least in part because America's liberal establishment was committed to apologizing for this bloodthirsty regime. They minimized, concealed, denied, and discredited factual reports of the atrocities and oppression, and demonized those who tried to bring it to the public's attention. Thankfully, in the end, there is a positive message for us in the saga of the Cold War, that once again, the American commitment to freedom and willingness to confront evil prevailed over a vicious foe, despite the fervent opposition, obstruction, hostility, and appeasing mindset of sympathetic liberalism. None of this would have been possible without the determination of one man, President Ronald Reagan, who was driven to take his place in American history by a basic faith in the American experiment in freedom and an equally passionate contempt for the evil of the Soviet Empire and the communist system that enslaved it. Before Reagan came onto the scene, however, the outlook for America in its historic struggle against Soviet communism looked anything but promising. By the late 1970s, the nation had slipped into a state of military decline and had degenerated into a spirit of pessimism and defeatism, with long gas lines, stagflation, double-digit interest rates, unemployment, and no prospect for better times. President Carter's proposed solution was austerity and sacrifice, doom and gloom, and ultimately surrender to the idea that America's better days were behind us. We were in such a state of